Science and Education. Science, to the ordinary reader of newspapers, is represented by a varying selection of sensational triumphs. It is not of this aspect of science that I wish to speak. Science in this aspect consists of detached, up-to-date fragments, interesting only until they are replaced by something newer and more up-to-date, displaying nothing of the systems of patiently constructed knowledge out of which, almost as a casual incident, have come the practically useful results which interest the general public. The increased command over the forces of nature, which is derived from science, is undoubtedly an amply sufficient reason for encouraging scientific research, but this reason has been so often urged and is so easily appreciated that other reasons, to my mind quite as important, are apt to be overlooked. It is with these other reasons, especially with the intrinsic value of a scientific habit of mind in forming our outlook on the world, that I shall be concerned in what follows. In the broader sense, education will include not only what we learn through instruction, but all that we learn through personal experience, the formation of character through the education of life. In the narrower sense, education may be confined to instruction, the imparting of definite information on various subjects, because such information in and for itself is useful in daily life. But instruction, necessary as it is, does not per se constitute education in the sense in which I wish to consider it. Education, in the sense in which I mean it, may be defined as the formation, by means of instruction, of certain mental habits and a certain outlook of life and the world. It remains to ask ourselves what mental habits and what sort of outlook can be hoped for as a result of instruction. When we have answered this question, we can attempt to decide what science has to contribute to the formation of the habits and outlook which we desire. Our whole life is built about a certain number, not a very small number, of primary instincts and impulses. Only what is in some way connected with these instincts and impulses appears to us desirable or important. There is no faculty, whether reason or virtue, or whatever it may be called, that can take our active life and our hopes and fears outside the region controlled by these first movers of all desire. All meaning must be at bottom related to our primary desires, and when they are extinct, no miracle can restore to the world the value which they reflected upon it. The purpose of education, therefore, cannot be to create any primary impulse which is lacking in the uneducated. The purpose can only be to enlarge the scope of those that human nature provided, by increasing the number and variety of attendant thoughts, and by showing where the most permanent satisfaction is to be found. But although nature must supply the initial force of desire, nature is not, in the civilized person, the spasmodic, fragmentary, and yet violent set of impulses that it can be in the uncivilized person. Each impulse has its constitutional ministry of thought and knowledge and reflection, through which possible conflicts of impulses are foreseen. Temporary impulses are controlled by the unifying impulse which may be called wisdom. In this way, education destroys the crudity of instinct and increases, through knowledge, the wealth and variety of the individual's contacts with the world, making him no longer an isolated fighting unit, but a citizen of the universe, embracing remote regions of space and vast stretches of past and future within the circle of his interests. It is this simultaneous softening of the insistence of desire and enlargement of its scope that is the chief moral end of education. Closely connected with this moral end is the purely intellectual aim of education, the endeavour to make us see and imagine the world in an objective manner, as far as possible as it is in itself, and not merely through the distorting medium of personal desire. The complete attainment of such an objective view is no doubt an ideal, indefinitely approachable, but not actually and fully realizable. Education, considered as a process of forming our mental habits and our outlook on the world, is to be judged successful in proportion as its outcome approximates to this ideal. If this standard is admitted, we can return to the consideration of science, inquiring how far science contributes to such an aim, and whether it is in any respect superior to other educational practices. The discovery of scientific method has already transformed the world, and its success proceeds with ever-accelerating velocity. No transcendent ability is required in order to make useful discoveries in science. The edifice of science needs its masons, bricklayers, and common laborers, as well as its foremen, master builders, and architects. In science, even a very moderate capacity can contribute to a supreme achievement. In science, the person of real genius is the person who invents a new method. The notable discoveries are often made by the successors, who can apply the method with fresh vigor, unimpaired by the previous labor of perfecting it. But the mental caliber of the thought required for their work, however brilliant, is not so great as that required by the first inventor of the method. There are in science immense numbers of different methods, appropriate to different classes of problems, but over and above them all, there is something so easily definable, which may be called the method of science. It was formerly customary to identify this with the inductive method. But the true method of science is something which includes deduction as much as induction, logic and mathematics as much as botany and geology. The kernel of the scientific outlook is a thing so simple, so obvious, so seemingly trivial, that the mention of it may almost excite derision. The kernel of the scientific outlook is the refusal to regard our own desires, tastes, and interests as affording a key to the understanding of the world. Stated thus baldly, this may seem no more than a trite truism. But to remember it consistently in matters arising our passionate partisanship is by no means easy, especially where the available evidence is uncertain and inconclusive. Aristotle considered that the stars must move in circles because the circle is the most perfect curve. In the absence of evidence to the contrary, he allowed himself to decide a question of fact by appeal to aesthetico-moral considerations. In such a case, it is at once obvious to us that this appeal was unjustifiable. We know now how to ascertain as a fact the way in which the heavenly bodies move, and we know that they do not move in circles, or even in accurate ellipses, or in any other kind of simply describable curve. This may be painful to a certain hankering after simplicity of pattern in the universe, but we know that in astronomy such feelings are irrelevant. Easy as this knowledge seems now, we owe it to the courage and insight of the first inventors of scientific method, and more especially to Galileo. Under the influence of Darwinism, the scientific attitude towards humanity has now become fairly common, and is to some people quite natural, though to most it is still a difficult and artificial contortion. The scientific attitude of mind involves a sweeping away of all other desires in the interests of the desire to know. It involves suppression of hopes and fears, loves and hates, and the whole subjective emotional life, until we become subdued to the material, able to see it frankly, without preconceptions, without bias, without any wish except to see it as it is, and without any belief that what it is must be determined by some relation, positive or negative, to what we should like it to be, or to be what we can easily imagine it to be. A certain self-absorption, not personal, but human, has marked almost all attempts to conceive the universe as a whole. Mind, or some aspect of it, thought, or will, or sentience, has been regarded as the pattern after which the universe is to be conceived, for no better reason at bottom than that such a universe would not seem strange, and would give us the cozy feeling that every place is essentially like home. To conceive the universe as essentially progressive or essentially deteriorating, for example, is to give to our hopes and fears a cosmic importance, which may, of course, be justified. Until we have learned to think of it in ethically neutral terms, we have not arrived at a scientific attitude. The instinct of constructiveness, which is one of the chief incentives to artistic creation, can find in scientific systems a satisfaction more massive than any epic poem. Curiosity, which is the source of almost all intellectual effort, finds with astonished delight that science can unveil secrets which might well have seemed forever undiscoverable. The desire for a larger life and wider interests, for an escape from solitary circumstances, and even from the whole recurring human cycle of birth and death, is fulfilled by the impersonal cosmic outlook of science, as by nothing else. To all these must be added, as contributing to the happiness of the person of science, the admiration of splendid achievement, and the consciousness of inestimable utility to the human species. A life devoted to science is therefore a happy life, and its happiness is derived from the very best sources that are open to dwellers on this troubled and passionate planet. This is David Case. Thank you for listening.
This has been a Highbridge audio presentation.